No Regrets. Cafe Conversations with Madeline Smith in conversation with Bill Lawrence. Episode 3.
And in this episode, Maddie takes another deep dive with me into her life, talking about childhood acting and first professional comedy roles, studio audiences and canned laughter, funny men being serious, and the masters of comedy, Leslie Phillips, Bernard Cribbins, Frankie Howard, Morecambe and Wise, The Two Ronnies, and Arthur Lowe. Hi there, Maddie, and welcome once more to another of our conversations here in the cafe. And this time I'd like to start off our chat by asking you, what does comedy mean to you?
It means everything, Bill. Without laughter, I actually couldn't have got through. I'm not going to go on, you know, beating my chest here, but it was a tricky childhood, very, very tricky childhood. I think a lot of people's childhoods were very tricky in the 1950s. We'd just come out of the war. There wasn't much to laugh about. And I don't know why, I don't know how, but I was a laughing child. And almost starting in the playpen, almost starting with the fact that I became incredibly fat because I didn't walk. And there are photographs of my dim laughing face, a smile hardly emerging from the fat folds. And my father was so desperate that I didn't walk that he lured me with a tube of Smarties. And it wasn't enough that I could shuffle on my behind to get the tube of Smarties. I actually raised myself off my, shall we say, porcine pig-like self and walked towards my father and snatched the tube of Smarties, and I was very nearly two, and boy was I big. I was roly-poly, is putting it politely. And you can already see that I'm wreathed in smiles, and it just seems to be part of my makeup. When I was about eight, I suppose, seven maybe, my rather difficult dad, I'm not going to start saying what an adorable person he was. He was very difficult. I loved him to pieces. But he was very difficult. But my goodness, he made me a shop and a doll's house. And I had a best friend, and I love her to pieces, and I still love her to pieces, and her name is Annie. And when Annie used to come to tea, we played with the doll's house and the shop. But we acted all the different parts, all the different little pipe cleaner people in the doll's house and all the weird pipe cleaner people that came to the shop. We were all of them, and we fell about. We were nearly sick with laughter. And why Annie, I shall smack her, didn't become an actress professionally, I have no idea, because she's brilliant. So we had lots of shrieks, and also I used to write plays, and I used to inflict them on my friends. And I had not only that, but I used to drag them upstairs to this dreadful garret room where I'd created a theatre out of an old wardrobe, and I made everybody dress up. So I was a real pill, actually. Golly. Anyway, so that's me, age 7 and 8. So laughter was already incredibly important to me, even then. And at school, I was making people laugh. I went to this convent school. Yes, I wanted to go, my idea, because I always thought it would be very romantic. And I can tell you now, it wasn't. Dusty Springfield went to my school. I don't know how she got on. Anyway, she made quite a stab at her career, I have to say. And we used to have to go to benediction on a Friday afternoon, as if we hadn't had enough with mass and all the other stuff. So I used to go to benediction on a Friday afternoon and be kneeling there, yes, smelling the smell of our dinner, because the kitchens were alongside the chapel. So I could smell the old cabbage and the baked beans in the chapel. And And I used to do rude things with my stomach to make people laugh. And I'm very, very naughty. So that's kind of the beginning of it all. So I fitted very neatly, if you like, into the world of comedy. And that's the world where I want to be. If a day passes and I haven't made people laugh, including myself, it's not a good day. I'm not a happy bunny. So I guess my first professional comedy was with the wonderful Bernard Cribbins. And I was terrible in it, but I sat in awe and watched Bernard and Carmel McSherry and Terence Brady and his wife Charlotte, and I was open-mouthed. He is so brilliant. And I was allowed to go to the recordings. I had, you know, two or three lines in it. I was allowed to go to the recordings, and well, I thought I'd gone to heaven. That was Thames Television, 1968. Might have been the beginning of 69. I don't want to have a debate about this. And then in 1971 came the turning point for me, which was that I got a part with Arthur Lowe, the master of all things comedy in the world that ever has been and ever will be. That man and his timing and his face and the fact that he doesn't pull his face in all different directions and he doesn't laugh at his own jokes and the way that he waits for the laugh and everything about that man is heaven. So I did five episodes of a series called Doctor at Large, and I played his daughter. And again, we did it with a live audience. And a lot of actors don't like doing comedy or situation comedy with a live audience. And I love it. I need an audience. I don't know why. I always have. I guess I like showing off, really.
So I'll just stop you there,
yeah,
Maddie.
Please do, Bill.
That's a really interesting point to say that not all actors like a live audience. Why do you think that is? Do they just feel that there's no room for mistakes, or that the audience are unpredictable? What is it that they are uncomfortable with?
Right, well, I can answer that immediately. They don't know if they're playing to the camera, and they don't know if they're playing to the audience. Which is it? You've got to forget about the camera, and you've got to play to the audience. Many, many actors find that far too confusing, and it makes them actually ill with terror. Now, I hadn't been warned about it. I'd never given it any thought. And because I'd already had the experience with Cribbins, I thought a live audience was just the best thing in the world. They're only tiny and they're behaving themselves. They've been warmed up by the warm-up man. They've been told to laugh. Even if you don't find it funny, you've got to laugh, you know, and he's making gestures in the background and, you know, they're told to clap when they clap. I mean, they have to behave themselves. So, however, I don't mind that at all. Not in the least. I just love it. I love the smell of the studio. I love the look of the audience. As I say, I don't know. Is it me showing off? I don't know. I do remember that a very nice director, actually, who's done one heck of a lot, did come to me when we were recording Casanova 73, Leslie Phillips and myself. He came up to me halfway through and he said, very unfairly, I think, Madeline, you're treading on all the laughs. Well, I've seen it several times now and I didn't tread on any laughs. And again, that was his nervousness. So it's very difficult to know whether you carry on going or whether you wait for the laughs when you've got a live audience and the camera. And after all, there is something called editing. So he was being a bit naughty. But again, as I think I've said elsewhere, I've learnt to realise that I'm not the only person that's suffering from nerves. The director and his job are probably a lot more important than I am. And he's trying to save his skin or her skin, and the nerves are his, not mine. And that's something that I've learnt to deal with. You know, as I've gone through my very long life, I've realised that. Anyway, I didn't take any notice, and that was a separate programme, but I will just say Leslie Phillips is heaven. But Arthur, he takes the biscuit. And so we used to rehearse in Stonebridge Park. Not the most glamorous place on earth, near Willesden Junction. And because I'm claustrophobic, I used to walk up the 20 flights in this Stonebridge building. And I remember Barry Evans saying to me on the first day of rehearsal, when I went in with a big beam on my face, "Oh," he said, "you'll grow out of this. Come the last day, you'll be absolutely sick to death of all this. He said, you know, all your enthusiasm will wane." Well, it didn't. I have to tell you that I'm still just as keen and just as enthusiastic today as I was then. I still love making people laugh, and I still do it. I may not be funny, though.
Always been intrigued. Do the television editors or the directors turn the laughter up or down? Were you aware that they could do that? Would they say, well, in the edit we can put a laugh in here using a sort of canned laughter, I think it's called, isn't it? Was that ever used?
Sometimes it is called canned laughter, and they'll do that if the audience isn't responding particularly well, and that's something that I've never played any part in. That would be done quietly with the director and the editor and so on, and the producer elsewhere afterwards. No, I've never ever been privy to that, and quite frankly, the people that I've worked with have been such genius, I wouldn't imagine they've ever had to use canned laughter. The Americans tend to use that, and they use it far too much, in my opinion, because you can tell.
The other thing I'd like to ask you is that a lot of people talk about comedians in real life aren't very funny people. They can be funny when they are required to be, and can actually be quite morose people.
Yes.
And the opposite of what you'd expect. Were people like Arthur Lowe like that, or was he quite a funny man in real life?
No, Arthur was quite serious, actually. And he told me that, you know, you must never, ever over-rehearse. And he would take me by the hand and he'd say, right, that's it, at lunchtime. We're going home now. I never over-rehearse. I save it for the night. And he said, and I shall bleed that, you know, whatever joke he was referring to, I shall be bleeding that for all it's worth. He never wanted to spoil it by over-rehearsing. And indeed, he was proved absolutely right. And I'm thinking of a particular sketch where some tadpoles were frozen into the ice cubes. Absolutely hilarious. I can't remember the total plot here. But obviously, when the ice cubes are put into the gin or whatever, obviously the tadpoles thaw, yes. So I do remember that a very, very young David Jason played the tadpoles or the frogs coming to life, and he did the gribbit noises off stage, or off camera, actually. So he was a very, very young David Jason in those days. So I've known them all, really, even almost in their nappies. So anyway, so to get on with this, so that was my first wonderful thing. And dear Barry Evans, who was really quite jaded by that time, which made me very sad. And the full answer to Bill's question is, Arthur was not funny in real life. He was very serious. Frankie Howard certainly wasn't funny in real life. He was very serious. Trying to think of, strangely enough, it's actors who can play funny parts that are funny in real life. And I'm going to name Paul Eddington and Michael Bates. Michael Bates did It Ain't Half Hot Mum. And Eddington did Yes Minister, It's a Good Life. And he, in real life, hilarious. And Michael Bates actually had me on the floor. And another one, Bill Patterson, who always plays dreadful villains and does lots of lovely voiceovers. He is absolutely stunningly funny. I did a radio play with him, and we had to be inmates in a lunatic asylum as sort of voices off in one scene, and I was nearly sick. When I say that, I actually mean that quite literally. I laughed so much that I was ill, in paroxysms of it, hiccuping and everything. So that's three actors playing funny parts who've had me in stitches and who are hilarious in real life. The comics take life very seriously. For them, comedy is their business, whereas these other guys, comedy is not their business, but they can do it. That all sounds very complex, doesn't it? And of course, we know that Hancock, I didn't work with Hancock, but I know he wasn't funny in real life. I will add, though, that little Patricia Hayes, who played with whom I spent so much time, she was very funny in real life, absolutely hilarious, had me in stitches. So it does vary, but I think the big stars, dear Eric Morecambe, wonderful man, was pretty serious in real life, but also had a huge sense of fun. So I don't want to be unfair. Actually, he did want to do jokes all the time. I think, Bill, the answer to that question is it varies. Arthur was very serious. Frankie Howard was very serious. But it's not a rule. It's not a rule. It varies. Ronnie Barker, not at all funny in real life, but I mean just a wizard. But then of course he's really an actor who can be funny. Whereas dear Ronnie Corbett is very funny in real life, but takes it very seriously. So there are no rules here. I wouldn't be able to write a book and say, you know, this is a rule book. There are no rules. Throw the rules out the window. When I did the first series, the whole of the first series of the two Ronnies, those two men had a pile of scripts, all the scripts, on their lap. And they went through them one by one by one by one, always on the Monday morning. And they ended up on the floor, quite literally on the floor. And the ones that worked, for them, I have to say, they weren't necessarily bad sketches. The ones that worked for them are the ones that they kept. So they absolutely, even though it was the first series of the two Ronnies, they held sway. Now, whether that always applies, I can't say, actually. I think on the whole, actors and comics I know that Eric Morecambe and Ernie, they definitely went through with a fine tooth comb. I know they did. They were very, very much a part of those meetings, those script meetings. I have worked with wonderful Eric Morecambe, but not in their show. I never met Ernie. But when it comes to the two Ronnies, yes. Ronnie Barker, actually, to be honest, Ronnie Barker pretty well directed those shows, those two Ronnies shows. He was boss, really. Corbett, darling little Corbett, he was more interested in his parts, his bits, his songs, his dances and things, whereas I would say that Ronnie Barker was the overseer. We had a very, very nice director, Terry Hughes, who then went off to America to direct Friends. Lovely guy, but I would say he was more a technician. Barker was responsible for my performance, whatever there was of it, 100%. And of course, he wrote my sketches. He wrote Hampton Wick, which was my spoof classic serial. So, and this is quite unusual, to find that your leading man or your leading comic is actually in charge is pretty unusual, actually. So the answer to Bill, as with all things with me, there are no rules.
These people were at the top of their game, they're the masters of comedy. Did they themselves realise how funny they were?
Well, I think Leslie Phillips, with whom I did the Casanova, I think that Leslie Phillips was very aware of his own talent. He didn't seem like an insecure chap to me at all. Just great, very integrated personality, I would say. Frankie Howard, on the other hand, I would say I'm going to use the word desperately insecure. I worked with Frankie many times, and I don't think he was ever secure in himself at all. I think he was always shaking with terror. I did a theatre play with him, and he always morose, worried, nervous that the audience didn't like him, that he wasn't funny. And I think partly that's one of the reasons that he was always chasing young men. I don't think it was necessarily a sexual thing. I think that it was a sort of comforter, a dummy. Ooh, maybe shouldn't say that. But it was a teddy under the arm, quite literally. It was enormous insecurity with Frankie. I don't believe that Frankie ever gave me the impression that he was ever sure that he was funny or popular or anything, and by gum, he was. He was totally adorable, but very, very nervous, sweaty, pasty, frightened, that dreadful toupee that he wore. He was never really happy to be himself when performing. I would say of Frankie, no. I don't want to go too deeply into it because obviously I wasn't intimate with him, but he never gave me the impression of being a secure person or secure in what he did. Arthur definitely was secure in what he did, and that's the reason that he said to me, I never like to over rehearse. And of course he honed his craft by immediately he'd finished whatever he was doing, whether it was Dad's Army or whatever, he'd go out into rep and always with his wife. So he was always, I believe he actually died, not necessarily on stage, but while performing. Some very, very sad story. I think that he was a very, very secure person, was Arthur. He worked himself to death because he never said no to anything. And that would be the same story for Eric Morecambe. I believe that Eric and Ernie were very secure about their own ability. I think that they weren't always secure about the substance of the programme or whether the script lived up to what they were able to do. So again, it's very, very variable, as with all things. I'm trying to think of other comics I've worked with. Bernard Cribbins is a very secure man, very secure of what he does. He knows he's darn good. He's a wonderful singer, actor. He's an all-rounder. I mean, he is most unusual, actually, Bernard Cribbins. He's got a wonderful way with children, too. He does some fantastic storytelling. So he's almost a unique and surviving talent. I mean, he's still doing it. So, yeah, I think, again, I'm really boring in this way, but I think it differs. And I think that probably the most secure are the actors who can do comedy, rather than perhaps some of the comics. Certainly, by reputation from my friend Patricia Hayes, certainly Hancock was never secure. And again, I think the those lovely characters, I did one half day in Carry On Matron. Certainly Hattie Jakes seemed like a very secure lady, and Barbara Windsor. I think Kenneth Williams, whom I encountered on one occasion, I think he was a very insecure guy. There's insecurity for you. He got by being profoundly rude to me, and not only to me, but to many people. And that sort of got him over the hump. By being foul to people, he felt better.
Let me take that one step further. You have these wonderful comedians who have perfected their art. And were they ever happy with their art? Did they ever feel that their art was valuable and worthwhile? Or were they always striving to do something which would satisfy them?
Ooh, that's a really, really difficult one. I think, again, it's about talent. I think maybe, and it's not for me to judge, I think perhaps the more insecure, perhaps in certain cases, the slightly less talented ones are more insecure and less satisfied, always striving for perfection and never quite getting there. I believe that Eric and Ernie and the wonderful, wonderful Peter Cook, with whom I worked, Now, there was an insecure gentleman. I think he was insecure once he'd been abandoned by Dud. Then he became insecure. I think when they were a double act, I think they were very secure. But then he went off and wanted to become a famous actor in America. And I think that Peter tried it and it didn't work. Oh, yes, my experience with Peter Cook was that he told me that he was dreaming about murdering Dud. So I think he felt very, very insecure from that moment on. That was really quite something for that gorgeous man to say that to me. Now, he was somebody who made me laugh until, again, I was completely incapable. Anybody that can make me laugh like that is my friend forever. For me, and I will say it again, and it's really how I started this whole segment, for me, laughter is the most important thing in life. Whether you're in hospital, in a hospital bed, if somebody can make you laugh when you're feeling like shit, that's the greatest gift. Laughter, for me, is the most important thing in life. Without it, I could not have got by.
That was episode 3 of No Regrets with Madeline Smith.